Welcome to the Education Gadfly Show. I'm your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Today, Nick Colangelo of the University of Iowa joins us to discuss the recommendations in our recent report from the National Working Group on Advanced Education. Then, on the Research Minute, Amber discusses a California study that investigates how within-school differences in school quality contribute to educational achievement gaps. All this on the Education Gadfly Show.
This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Sorry if that was a privacy violation there, but you do look jet-lagged.
I am jet-lagged, thank you.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. You're at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please welcome our special guest for this week, Nick Colangelo. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, Nick is the Dean Emeritus of the College of Education at the University of Iowa and a member of the National Working Group on Advanced Education. We are going to talk all about that working group because its final report is out. Also joining us as always, David Griffith.
Hey, Mike. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, well, Nick, really appreciate you joining us. For those of you that don't know Nick, who maybe are not engaged in the world of gifted and talented education, Nick is a giant in that field and has been for many years. For a long time, the University of Iowa's education school has been a rare place that has taken the needs of advanced learners seriously and has done a lot of the best research on gifted and talented education over the years. And that is why we invited Nick to be a part of this national working group, which he served on over the past year. This is a group of about 20 of us who were charged with trying to develop a set of recommendations for states and school districts and charter school networks about how to best serve the needs of advanced learners. And we now have our final report out. We gave that report. We really wrestled with the title, Nick. We didn't want this to sound super boring. So we went with building a wider, more diverse pipeline of advanced learners. And we think that pipeline is more important than ever, especially given a certain Supreme Court decision that we expect any day now. So we'll get to that in a moment.
On Ed Reform Update.
First of all, welcome. And second of all, tell us, you have been in this field for a long time. It seems like there has been a lot of news around gifted and talented programs, exam schools, honors programs, you know, whether schools should let kids take algebra early. These controversies have been front page news. Is this unusual in your experience?
Well, the controversies are not unusual. Ever since I've been in this field, since the early 70s, there's always been, I don't want to use things like love-hate relationship, but you know what? Love-hate relationships. But I would say that recently, things have gotten even more in terms of front burner. I think what gifted education or dealing with advanced learners does is it triggers in all of us a sense of what is egalitarianism, what is democracy, and also don't kids have a right to be identified for their strengths and meet those strengths? And so it goes back and forth. And I think in today's political climate, the whole issue of the idea of equity, which for many people means that we basically do the same for everyone, that there are no differentiations, which is honestly, Michael, a poor sense of equity, because equity is much more complex, much more nuanced than that. And you hardly ever hear the word equity when you come to kind of remedial programs, even though there's a selection process. It always has to do with programs of advanced learners, gifted education. And, you know, I don't know if this report, if there was ever a bad time for this report to come out, but it certainly has come out at a really important time because I think people are ready to hear, to read something that I think will capture them. And just because this report not only focuses on advanced education, but specifically also meeting the needs of typically underrepresented students in that, I don't know if there could have been a more critical time to have a report like this come out.
Well, and you know, this working group was put together to be purposely very diverse, certainly racially and by gender, but also ideologically. And you know, I think if people look at the report, they'll see some things that they wouldn't usually see, say, in a Fordham Institute report. You know, we are taking seriously some of the concerns of the left that maybe sometimes we, you know, we wouldn't as much. You'll see a lot on here, for example, about culturally responsive teaching. We say in this report that even the terminology needs to change, that gifted and talented education, it comes with a lot of baggage. And frankly, it earned that baggage because for many years, gifted programs in too many places, they were racist, they were classist. They did exclude kids who could have benefited from them. And so we argue in the report that we should think about language that's more inclusive, things like advanced learning opportunities. And really that inclusion is one of the key themes, that the too many places they have this idea where we've got to create this sense of scarcity. You know, we're only going to let 2% of the kids into these programs because we want to make sure it's only the kids who are really precocious and possibly geniuses. And so we're going to have this very narrow entranceway. We're saying, no, open it up to any child who could benefit from that. I mean, that's a new, somewhat new idea in this field, right, Nick?
Yeah. And, you know, again, you're correct. Such a history of gifted education has been like to produce and highlight a scarcity, because the rarer you could make something, somehow it had greater value. And that really, really hurt the field. It really hurt, you know, I think kids that were associated with gifted. That's why I was really in favor of it's time to do away with that term, you know, because it does reel in so much baggage and so forth. Plus, the idea of gifted is more about, it's a static term. It's kind of who you are, who we've labeled, rather than what you do. And I think what this report really gets at is what's your willingness to do something? What's your motivation? What are you willing to strive for? And that, I think, is a much better sense of what advanced learning is all about. So I think the right moves have been on this. You know, and as we know in so many other fields, language is important. We've let go of a number of terms and words that were at one time acceptable, but right now we would see them as basically destructive. And I see the same thing. Gifted education, whatever good it did to identify kids, it's time to move on from that and think about more of a verb rather than a noun.
That's right. And that it's not just a binary, either you're gifted or you're not. You know, it's more like, how can we best serve this child? We all are trying to figure out how to make our system more individualized. And so that may mean that a certain child is ready to do advanced level work in math, but not in English, you know, or go further or deeper in history, but not in science. And so can we have a system that that can provide those kinds of specializations and serve the needs of kids? All right, well, there are something like 30 recommendations in this report, so we can't go through them all. But a couple of the big things that we're trying to tell school districts and charter schools, let's just start at the beginning. It's universal screening, right? No more of this, you know, having parents or teachers be the ones that nominate kids for gifted and talented programs or whatever we're going to call them, right? Screen everybody to make sure nobody falls through the cracks.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Super big one. And then once you find kids who are ready to accelerate, allow them to accelerate. Now, this is a topic you care an awful lot about. You've written about this and studied it, this notion of acceleration. And not the way we use the term right now after the pandemic. We say, well, we want to accelerate learning for everybody, which we do, right? But acceleration in the field of gifted and talent has specific meaning. Tell us about that.
Okay, well, first of all, I do want to go back to a comment. I think it's really important that people understand we are talking about universal screening, because without that, you're constantly having the same biases. You know, if you're going to have teachers recommend or whatever. So universal screening is something we can do now. We have the ability to think about that. And there's no excuse to miss kids. You know, so at least universal screening will get closer and closer to that. Going to your comment about acceleration, yes, I've done considerably work on that. I'm absolutely a proponent, because what I have found and what research backs up is that when students are given advanced learning opportunities, when the pace and the complexity are closer to a person's readiness, good things happen. And for too many years, acceleration was sort of the the nasty word. It's like, okay, we'll go with enrichment. That sounds, you know, not so painful. Or we'll go with this and that. Acceleration doesn't mean moving a student, you know, ahead of himself, herself, or anything. What it means is getting the pace to really what the student is ready for.
But let's be clear, Nick, we are saying things like grade skipping, right? In some cases, letting a kid skip a grade, right? Or if they're in second grade, but ready for third grade math.
If a student in fourth grade is ready for sixth grade work, you're just putting that student into where his or her peers are. You know, it's not so much you're letting go of third grade, you're just getting into where you are. And for a lot of people, the idea of grade skipping feels very threatening. That, you know, social emotional issues, research hasn't bared that out. Okay. And that's kind of a fairly extreme form, but you know, there's a lot of students who are in fourth grade and take math with the sixth graders, the seventh graders. Okay. There's nothing all that exotic about it. It just says if you're ready for sixth or seventh grade math, but you're doing fourth grade math, honestly, Michael, who gains by that kind of inconsistent situation? Why let a girl just sit around treading water when you could have made an adjustment without spending tremendous amount of money and you know, issues? So, you know, some of this stuff is really pretty simple. So I'll put it in as simple terms I can. What does it cost to have a fourth grade girl take sixth grade math and then come back to fourth grade for everything else? You don't need a new building. You don't have to hire new teachers. I mean, some of this is just so doable in the kids' game. To me, there's nothing worse than having kids tread water. Not what we can do something about that.
No, that's right. And of course, you know, I would argue even more important if you're talking about kids who are in high poverty schools, where maybe on average the achievement is quite low. But here you have a child who's high achieving and who's ready to do above grade level work. You know, they need that opportunity, because if they stay at their same grade level, they might spend most of the time doing below grade level work. Doesn't make any sense. Let me get David in here. The listeners can't tell. David's looking a little sleepy. David, we missed you the last 2 weeks. We did tell our listeners you were in France. Sorry if that was a privacy violation there, but you do look jet lagged.
I am jet lagged. Thank you.
Yes. All right. Well, but you know, one thing we've been saying with this report is that, you know, it is coming at a time, of course, when the Supreme Court is about to rule on affirmative action in higher education. Here we go again. I think most people expect the conservative majority to say that that racial preferences in admissions is unconstitutional. We'll see. But if they do that, of course, a lot of us are very worried about what that means for diversity in our higher education institutions. You know, one thing we argue in this report is if we're serious about having that kind of diversity, we can't wait till kids are in 12th grade. We got to start when kids are in kindergarten. You know, we got to look for every single kid, including Black and Hispanic, low-income kid who could do advanced level work, and give them the support they need all the way through K through 12. Again, we outlined these 30 steps that districts can do. I mean, can you imagine that becoming part of the conversation, David, or is it just... is this too polarized an issue when it comes to that topic?
I can absolutely imagine it, Mike. And I think in many ways, it already is part of the conversation. I think the conversation is just sort of weirdly disjointed, right? On the one hand, we're trying to close achievement gaps. On the other hand, we're talking about debating affirmative action in higher ed. And it's like we just never connect the dots, right? For reasons I don't totally understand. I think... I don't want to say it's a sideshow, but I do think that the impacts of whatever court decision comes through are probably not going to be as large as people fear, right? I mean, ultimately, you go to Harvard, you go to Brown, wherever it is, you're probably going to do all right in life. It's probably going to be mostly determined by what comes after that, you know, what your life outcomes are. I think it is incumbent on all of us to take this more seriously. And yeah, I think hopefully it'll focus minds. I mean, what is the alternative?
Right. Well, Nick, you know, again, we talked a little bit about it, acceleration. That's something we think about largely in the elementary grades. But of course, once we get to middle school and high school, in most places, thankfully, there are opportunities for honors courses, advanced placement, now dual enrollment. Lots of chances for kids to take challenging coursework. We talk about the need to have lots of on-ramps. Some kids are late bloomers. Again, inclusion. Look for kids who could benefit and do the work. That doesn't mean everybody, but it does. It also doesn't mean a tiny percentage of kids, and then give them the support that they need.
I think two points in the report that are really worth emphasizing. One is this idea of universal screening. Don't shut doors that you don't need to, you know, give every kid a chance. And then the other part of it is the continuous on-ramps. You know, for so long we've treated, whether we target gifted education, high ability kids, that once you're in, basically you're in for life unless you really, you know, want out. And if you're not in, you know, the wall to get in is really, really tall. And that's one of the major errors we made, that, you know, we deny the idea that development exists, kids change, you just never know. And to have walls that are impermeable is really against the whole idea. And so I think if people want to really get at the heart of this report, it's the idea of universal screening and the idea of on-ramps. And I guess the third one is really, we talked about as a committee, the idea of local norms. You know, so many times we talked about, well, you have to have an IQ that puts you, like, let's say, in the top 3% in the nation. But you're not, kids go to school, and it's who else is in your class. And if they're all working at level B and you're at level A, then you need something. You may not need that same thing if you were at some other school, but you need it there. And that's the purpose of really good advanced program, is that you take the atmosphere, you take the local norms. And if we can shatter this idea that you have to be among the top 2 or 3% in the nation, we will have done a lot of good.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. Really appreciate you coming on and being a part of this working group. Nick Colangelo, Dean Emeritus of the College of Education at the University of Iowa. Again, check out the National Working Group on Advanced Education's new report called Building a Wider, More Diverse Pipeline of Advanced Learners. It's on Fordham's homepage. Thanks again, Nick.
Thank you.
Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
I gotta say, it was such a fun experience getting to work on this National Working Group on Advanced Education.
Yeah. You know,
especially now in our polarized time, to have a group that really was very diverse, you know, certainly racially, but also ideologically, and, you know, lots of different backgrounds and academics and practitioners and advocates. And but we were able to come up with, I think, some pretty great recommendations. So
that is awesome. No big fights in the behind the scenes, Mike?
Oh, of course there were some fights. But you know what? We were able to disagree without being disagreeable.
Find
some common ground. Look, it's tough. I will say that I think the toughest issue in the field is when it comes to the selective admissions high schools.
Okay.
You know, which plenty of folks, even gifted education advocates, a lot of people think, why do we need these high schools at all? We should in kids, but we do have them. And in some places they are, you know, phenomenal institutions. And so the question is how to make them more accessible, how to maybe have more of them.
Parents seem to like them, you know?
Oh my gosh, of course. And, you know, like everything else, look, we have this artificial scarcity, you know?
That's right.
We need more from K to 12.
That's right. I like it. That was one of your recommendations, right?
That's right. That is in there. That is in there. All right. Well, what do you have for us on the research front this week?
Oh, man, we have a wonky study. I'm sorry David couldn't make it today because he's the one who sent this one to me, and I think you'll like it. But it is definitely wonky in terms of the methodology. But it asks an important question, which is, do schools provide equal value added to all students? So the previous studies and literature seem to say that school quality and teacher quality mostly assumes that good schools and good teachers mean they're beneficial for all students in the same school. We do have some research on assigning students to a same race or teacher, and that seems to be a little bit more of the ilk that we're talking about here, which is, you know, is it really the case that you can have these schools be equally effective no matter, you know, who they're teaching? So this one asks whether a school is effective for a specific type of students, and it compares those results with the standard value added model that typically controls for prior test scores and student demographics. It's not to say that those standard models, you know, they also agree that these within school differences in value added exist. They tend to estimate they account for about 7% of the gender gap in test scores, for instance. But the difference with this study is it's allowing for those that within school heterogeneity in the model from the get-go. So it's calculating a distinct value added for different subgroups. And they do that basically by eliminating the corresponding fixed effects for whatever they're estimating. So
I do wish David were here, but okay, yes, I will pretend that I understand all that.
Matthew Navin, I don't know him. He's the only PI and researcher, Washington and Lee. Uh-huh. He uses individual level data on the universe of California public school students spanning 2002 through 2013. Mm-hmm. He has data linked to post-secondary records. He's targeting grades 4 through 11, since we don't have test score data for grades 2 through 3. He uses ELA primarily because those students, if you look at math, you've got students being tracked to these non-comparable math tests starting in grade 7. So this is ELA. Okay. He uses, again, standard value added models, and then he extends those models. It's called a drift methodology, Mike. And this drift methodology has been honed by Raj Chetty and Jonah Rockoff, which, hey, those are some pretty smart economists there. And that model allows value added to change from year to year, which is important since schools experience faculty and staff turnover, which could impact their quality from year to year. And then the drift methodology adds three additional controls, which is important. Neighborhood, based on census tract characteristics. They get that from the American Community Survey. They control for older siblings who live at the same address, and they include their prior test scores and their college enrollment status as controls. Mm. And peers. That takes into account peers' prior test scores that may differ by grade and subgroup. And again, this within school model allows Navin to calculate value added for each school's high and low SES students. Mm-hmm. Those are defined as living in a household with a median income of $60,000 versus $100,000 for the, you know, the kids who are living in a little higher income families. Also, he's looking.
Wait. He's got income data? That's impressive.
He does.
Okay.
Each school's minority and non-minority students, so looking at them differently, minority in this case is everyone except white and Asian students who get put in the same bucket. And then he's looking at each school's male and female students, so kind of breaking it out by those different subgroups with, again, those additional controls. All right, results. These standard value added models tend to suggest that on average, schools provide less value added to low SES minority and male students. But in this case, when you control for neighborhood, older siblings, and peer characteristics, like I just kind of walked you through, and you allow, you know, this varying value added by subgroup, you see that schools actually show similar value added when it comes to low and high SES kids. And similar value added when it comes to minority and non-minority kids, meaning essentially that these within school differences are playing very little to no role in SES and racial gaps. But, and this is a wrinkle, schools show more value added to females. Specifically, these within school differences account for 6% of the gender gap in test scores. Then they turn to post-secondary enrollment. That was just the test scores. And they find, again, that this within these within school differences account for very small differences between minorities and non-minorities and between poor and wealthier kids. But again, they see the difference with gender, accounting for 22% of the difference in college enrollment between men and women. And then finally, the study looks at a bunch of simple correlations between certain school characteristics and the value added for these various subgroups. This kind of, again, these are associations. One that stood out to me, given that we've had all this race match work, was that schools with more minority teachers were linked or associated with lower value added on test scores for high SES kids, non-minority kids, and male and female kids. But that negative correlation goes away for low SES kids and minority kids, meaning that those kids are essentially unaffected. It wasn't better, it wasn't worse. The negative correlation just went away. But still, the biggest takeaway from all of it seems to be that these within school differences have the most impact on the college enrollment gap between men and women, such that schools seem to be better at increasing the chances that women will attend college. And then they go through a bunch of other implications and say, hey, states might want to keep this info in mind when they're using value-added estimates in their accountability systems. And what are the implications for those?
Ooh, okay. So let me see if I can understand it. Is this basically they are trying to perfect the value-added methodology?
Yes.
Right? So that we really are capturing real value-added, right, from the school.
Right. Not within the school.
Within the school. Right.
Yes.
And the good news is if we have, if we use these methodologies and you get a read on, say, this school is a high value added school, used to be that meant that there'd be these differences between poor kids and non-poor kids in terms of value added. With this methodology, that seems to go away.
That's right.
All right. But this finding on the girls, does this just mean that schools are just better at improving the achievement of girls? Is that?
I mean, that it seems to be that they're better at increasing the chances that women will go to college. Because, again, when we looked at the minority differences and the SES differences, they weren't there. But again, it popped up with gender. But remember, we didn't see it. We saw it in, test scores. Again, when we looked at test scores and post-secondary enrollment with that 6%, explanation of the gender gap within school.
Yeah.
So we saw it both with the test score and with the post-secondary enrollment.
Right. So it's like any way you look at it, good schools are better for girls than they are for boys, which, I mean, sort of intuitively makes sense, right? I mean,
yes.
We know that girls are doing a lot better academically, both on test scores and on college enrollment.
Right. I don't know. We always kind of commiserate over the boys, and here we go again. We know that, for the most part, a college degree is going to be good for boys, overall. So I don't know. And it's just, I don't know what's going on here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and, I guess this question is what kinds of measures of school quality might have the most impact? Where might this be flipped, for example?
Mm-hmm. So,
I don't know. Maybe if, we've been playing around with this notion of attendance value added,
it's
possible that places that are particularly good at boosting attendance maybe has a differential impact that could be in the direction of boys. I mean, I'm just playing around with this now. Or some things that maybe have more to do, if we look at outcomes on, maybe some great schools on measures that have more to do with career readiness. And that
right. Workplace readiness. Yep.
Impacts. Mm-hmm. Right.
All
right. Well, I have to admit, I don't completely understand this one, Amber, but I think I sort of get it.
Yes.
And I like it that they're refining. I do wonder if most states have just the data that they would need to be able to do these measures, these more complicated measures.
And well, course, that's right. And everybody, getting National Student Clearinghouse data isn't as easy as some people think, which is what they had to do here. So,
yeah. But look, measures matter. So it's important that we keep getting better and better. And the message to schools is, look, we really want to judge you based on what you've got control over. And we want to make sure that we're not, there's not some bias hidden in there that's not fair to you. So.
Right. That's right. I mean, and looking at neighborhood, neighborhood, older siblings, peer characteristics. I mean, wow, these are some, these are unique variables that they were able to control for, especially the older siblings, right?
I'm like, I'm like, boy, I don't know. I'm being judged according to my older siblings. I'll have to talk about that at the next family gathering.
Right. So anyhow, some sophisticated stuff.
Good. All right. Well, Amber, that is all the time we've got for this week. So until next week,
I'm Amber Northern.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.